Lecture 21. Last week we discussed that if the zoo of particles contains scalar particles, and if those scalar particles behave according to a field theory that has a potential, that has a suitable shape, then the universe is unstable. It's unstable because at any moment, at any place, it could happen that that scalar field fluctuates somewhere in a patch such that its amplitude reaches values which make its potential go close to the Planck scale. In this case, if this patch is large enough, homogeneous enough, so that derivatives don't matter, then the potential will dominate the energy momentum tensor and will make that patch expand explosively. It will exponentially quickly expand. This can happen anytime, anywhere, even in a universe that's filled with cars and trees and everything. So there might be inhomogeneities there, there might be matter around, but once this process of the mushrooming out of a new daughter universe has started, it will create so much space that whatever might have been there in or around that patch is completely diluted. So any matter that might have been there before will now be spread out over a gigantic volume, and therefore we can consider the matter density in that gigantic volume to be almost zero. Similarly, if that patch originally had some curvature, well, it'll be stretched out to enormous scales so that that stretch is basically flat. So the theory of cosmic inflation, therefore, provides us with a mechanism that produces every now and then a fresh universe that is gigantic, flat, and empty. Well, the emptiness problem is solved eventually when the potential drops back to the value zero or close to it, and all that energy density goes into the production of particles. So that when inflation ends, we have a universe that's filled with a hot, dense soup of particles. But we still have this problem that the universe, according to inflation, ought to be extremely flat and extremely smooth, just because it has been blown up to such huge scales. Now it turns out that quantum fluctuations of fields and of the curvature imprint some inhomogeneities, some structure on that universe. So inflation does two things. It flattens out and empties whatever used to be there previously, and then it repopulates with particles from the energy density, and it imprints inhomogeneities in that primordial soup of particles, inhomogeneities that come from quantum fluctuations. So now, how do we calculate those? Remember, we have to assume that the scalar field has some suitable potential V. It could, in practice, be as simple as phi squared, m squared phi squared. But to see the features most clearly, it is usually, one usually considers this textbook example of a potential, it's a bit of a caricature. So it's a potential that has some flat part with a small slope downwards, and then eventually it's more steeply falling down to zero. The field, if it has this potential, normally is right there. The field amplitude will be right there somewhere because that's the lowest energy. But sometimes, and that's when a new universe gets generated, sometimes the field phi might find itself somewhere over here with the value, rare but happening. Then the potential is high in that region where this happened, and so the universe starts to explode exponentially, And while it does that, the potential will slowly try to go back to zero. And the dynamics is that of the dynamics, as we discussed last time, is described by an equation which is very similar to a ball rolling down an incline and having a friction term. So inflation is happening while the potential is up there and slowly decreasing, while the field value phi is moving back to the resting position over there. So this is the time period during which inflation is happening. And then as the value of the field crosses about this threshold here, then the potential starts to drop more quickly. And that means inflation comes to an abrupt halt. Then the universe just goes on coasting with some sort of maybe polynomial behavior, but not exponential, not exponentially. The strategy for calculating through the standard model of cosmology is therefore twofold. These calculations we do classically. So we treat the metric as an FRW metric with a scale factor A of t, and we call it A naught of t because it's unperturbed. There are no wiggles in space-time, it's just a clean FRW, completely homogeneous and isotropic space-time. So the strategy is twofold. We study the evolution of the Klein-Gordon field and the evolution of the scale factor in the FRW universe, where everything only depends on time but not on space. So the Klein-Gordon field is having the same value everywhere, it just evolves in time. The scale factor has the same value everywhere, it just evolves in time. And the dynamics, the intertwined dynamics between what the scale factor does and what the Klein-Gordon field does, we treat classically and just by solving the differential equations in question, which are of course the Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation. This gives us a zero order approximation to what is going on. It tells us how space-time is expanding when neglecting any ripples that might come about because of quantum fluctuations. So using this, we calculate through this inflationary period that runs from some initial time to some final time over here. Somebody asked me, so if the quantum field fluctuates, just a comment, if the quantum field is able to fluctuate to the extreme that it goes from here about the minimum where it usually is, to some extreme value where the potential is high, why does it bother slowly rolling back instead of just fluctuating back? Well, it could, it's just very rare. See? Okay, so today we start calculating the quantum fluctuations that happen during that time. And we do it by perturbing around that classical solution. To that purpose, we will write the inflaton field, phi of x and eta, so the full inflaton field that has space dependence as well as time dependence. We write this as the classical solution, phi naught of eta, the solution to this classical problem here that doesn't have a space dependence. We write it as this classical field plus a perturbation. I'm using this script phi to describe the perturbation around that classical field phi. And this thing we will quantize. And we will assume that the amplitude of this is small compared to the amplitude of that, so that we can do perturbation theory. And that's a good assumption, about 5 or 6 orders of magnitude in between in practice. Now, if only it were as simple as that, but we don't get away with doing just this. And that's because fluctuations in the inflaton field will generate fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor, and that will generate fluctuations in the metric. So when the field phi is fluctuating, then the energy momentum tensor of the Klein-Gordon field, which takes this form, will fluctuate, as well. Remember, we are assuming here that the Klein-Gordon field dominates the energy momentum tensor at early times. So the energy momentum tensor has in it terms that involve the derivatives of the inflaton field as well as m squared phi squared. The Einstein equation, remember, has the energy momentum tensor on the right hand side, and on the left hand side it has all things curvature. This, by the way, is similar to the Maxwell equations. It is useful sometimes to compare the two. The Maxwell equations typically have derivatives of the electric and magnetic fields on the left hand side, and the Maxwell equations have on the right hand side currents and charges. Similarly here, we have curvature degrees of freedom, and they in some sense can behave like electric and magnetic fields, and I will discuss that a little later. And on the right hand side we have what causes curvature, namely energy and momentum. Just like in electromagnetism, electric and magnetic fields are caused by charges and currents. In general relativity, curvature is caused by energy and momentum. So if phi is allowed to quantum fluctuate, not that we have any choice in this, but if we accept that it does, well, then we have to accept that this will fluctuate, and therefore that should fluctuate as well. Therefore, let's just do the same thing for the metric. We write the metric tensor as a function of both space and time, as the metric tensor of an FRW space-time, just as above, with the assumption of spatial homogeneity and isotropy, which is this one. Remember, for FRW space-times, we can write the metric tensor when we use co-moving coordinates and conformal time, simply a scale factor times the eta mu nu matrix, plus perturbations. So the gamma mu nu is a symmetric covariant root sensor that perturbs the FRW metric, and this thing will in general be space and time dependent. And again, we assume that these perturbations are small. We will have to quantize that. We will keep this classical, but those perturbations we will track dynamically and quantize that. So it's really quantum gravity. It's just perturbative quantum gravity. So in principle, it seems that the problem is well defined. We are studying the quantum theory of the metric and of the Klein-Gordon field, or more precisely of the perturbations of the metric and the perturbations of the Klein-Gordon field. And we have two equations for basically two unknown kinds of functions, with the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. Why don't we just go ahead and solve that? The thing is that it's mathematically hard to do that, too hard, and more than that, it's beyond difficult, because it's just not consistent. If you try to do that perturbation theory, you find that in higher order perturbation theory, infinities will arise. And in principle, that's not so new. If you did the same thing for electromagnetism, you would find the same results. There are infinities in higher order perturbation theory. In quantum electrodynamics, these infinities can be handled. It's an intricate procedure called renormalization, and those of you who have taken quantum field theory for particle physics have probably learned about it. But that trick doesn't work for gravity. So renormalization is the idea that those infinities can be removed by accepting that the parameters that go into the action might actually be running parameters. So you are cutting off your integrals to make them finite, and then you're adjusting your running parameters, such as the coupling constants, the charges, that is to say, like the fine structure constant in electromagnetism, you're choosing them different from what you thought they would be, like the fine structure constant, 1 over 137, and so on. You choose them different from that. You choose them such that with the cutoff integral, your predictions for certain experiments come out right. Okay? I'm just giving you a hint of how a renormalization works. Now, if you remove that cutoff, then you have to let your fine structure constant and other parameters of the theory run. Always such that your prediction for certain experiments that you actually perform come out right. And this way you get running coupling constant, running masses, running charges, and so on. And they run in a particular way with the way your cutoff is removed. And in this way, if you apply that running now to other experiments that you may not have performed yet, you will get predictions for what the outcomes might be. And they come out right in general. So this is how normally the infinities are being dealt with. You have to accept that you may have to renormalize, in fact, infinitely renormalize your charges and masses. And instead of just having one mass, one charge for each particle, you have a function that describes how the masses and how the charges are running as a function of the cutoff. And the cutoff is a short distance cutoff, because the momenta diverge at the integrations diverge at large momenta. Now, for general relativity, unfortunately, that procedure doesn't work. What happens is that you generate more and more variables. The theory is just not predictive. If you keep doing this, then just because you fix your masses and charges and so on to get a few experiments right doesn't even help you, doesn't even allow you to make predictions for other experiments. That's just how the math comes up. So it's beyond difficult. We don't even know how to do it in principle. It's not predictive. However, if we just restrict attention to the lowest order in perturbation theory, then we can get still away with it. We can still do it. So to lowest order in perturbation, we will work in lowest order of perturbation theory, well knowing that the higher orders are not just bad, but inconsistent as far as we know. So we work with lowest order perturbation theory, and we do it in this way. We start with the lowest order would be no perturbations, right? So it's like one order above that. So the lowest order would be just FRW spacetime. Everything is flat, no fluctuations. We take that as the lowest order. That's FRW metric and the inflaton field. Everything spatially constant and just following the classical equations. And then we quantize only to the first non-trivial order, the perturbations around the inflaton field and around the FRW metric. Mm-hmm.
So even when we are dealing just with the perturbations on the inflaton field feed those in the metric, and vice versa. So that doesn't lead to a runaway kind of a situation where they are feeding each other?
No, it's consistent, except as we will discuss on Thursday, in the case of exact de Sitter inflation, you get some inconsistency. But other than that, it's fine. But don't take my word for it. We'll explain it. We'll get to it. So once we do this approximation that the perturbations of the Klein-Gordon field, the inhomogeneities in the Klein-Gordon field, the fluctuations are small compared to the bulk of the field, the classical part of it, and the same assumption is made for the metric, then we get tremendous benefits from that approximation. And that's basically because the equations of motion of the Klein-Gordon equation for the perturbations in phi, the Einstein equations for the perturbation perturbations in the metric, both become very very simple. Basically, linear in phi and gamma, because that's just where we truncate. And that removes a lot of couplings between the degrees of freedom. Ultimately, gravity couples to everything, and therefore everything couples to everything, at least through gravity. But making this approximation simplifies things tremendously. Remember, ultimately, the key problem with the quantization of gravity is that it's a highly nonlinear theory. But we are linearizing it to this order. So it turns out that the perturbation fields phi and gamma are just quadratic, have quadratic action terms. They don't have any potential terms and not any mass terms either. So what we will find is that we get free non-interacting theory for the inflaton field phi. And when I speak of the inflaton field phi, I mean the part that we are quantizing, the part that is perturbing around the homogeneous isotropic classical inflaton field. So the inflaton field and the metric perturbation field both obey simple non-interacting equations of motion. So we have non-interacting quantum field theory, and all that apparatus that we developed during this course can be applied. The non-triviality in the evolution doesn't stem from interactions between gravitons or what other complicated collisions. No, the non-triviality stems entirely from the fact that it's all happening on a non-trivial, namely expanding space-time. It's all because of the dynamics of the bulk inflaton field and the FRW expansion of space-time. It's not quite as simple as I made it sound like just now. There are two more sources of non-triviality. Namely, first of all, we should find that there is an interdependence between the perturbations of the inflaton field and the perturbations of the metric. And that's because they couple through the Einstein equation. On one hand, we can say that the inhomogeneities of the metric are caused by inhomogeneities or quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field, because the inflaton field generates contributions to the energy momentum tensor, which then in the Einstein equation affects the curvature and therefore the metric perturbations. So we can say that what's really fluctuating is the inflaton field, and it is these fluctuations are driving metric fluctuations. But vice versa, we can also say that no, the quantum field of the metric is fluctuating, and that, through the Einstein equation, is making our inflaton field fluctuate. It's really pointless to argue the one or the other case. Both are right. This is very similar to electromagnetism, again, where you can say that charges and currents produce electromagnetic fields. But really, you can also say that if electromagnetic fields do such and such thing, then there must be charges and currents. The Maxwell equations don't distinguish between, don't say which is driving which. It's commonly thought that, or it's commonly thought of as the charges and the currents driving the electromagnetic field. But for example, in string theory, there's a generalization of electromagnetism. And there, so-called D-brains, which are analogs of particles, just higher dimensional ones, were found because it was found that there are solutions to what would be like electromagnetic fields, which indicate that on the right-hand side, there must be inhomogeneities. There must be things like charges and currents that generate those fields. And they then had to be certain D-brains. Anyway, here in inflation, we have that matter drives curvature, or curvature drives matter. They're simply coupled. On the other hand, and that's the second source of non-triviality, not all of the fluctuations of the metric can be expected to be linked to or identified with fluctuations of the inflaton field. It's just simple counting. The inflaton field has only one scalar degree of freedom. The metric is tensorial. It would be a miracle if all of the metric fluctuations could be explained as fluctuations of the scalar field. So remember, gravity is a tensorial force, and it has some similarities to electromagnetism. And one aspect I want to highlight here is this. Some electromagnetic fields only exist because there are charges and currents. Let's say you have some solid, and in this solid are charges and currents going around. Then clearly in this solid there must be a lot of electromagnetic forces. There must be a lot of electromagnetic fields. But outside of that solid, you typically also have some remnant electromagnetic fields. For example, if that solid has a net charge, well then there's going to be some electromagnetic field, some static potential outside that solid as well. And if in that solid there are some currents, then you also have some magnetic fields that will be outside of that solid. In other words, even where there is vacuum, outside of that solid, even where there's vacuum, there can be electric and magnetic fields that have been caused by something that's going on inside that solid. So electromagnetic fields exist not only right there where the charges and the currents are, but also sometimes a little bit far away. If in that solid things are changing periodically in time, then you can get a further phenomenon, which is propagating waves. If in that solid you have things going in an alternating way, charges or currents, then outside you will have electric fields and magnetic fields that alternate. But remember from the Maxwell equations that electric fields that change in time produce magnetic fields. And magnetic fields that change in time produce electric fields. So they can sustain each other. And that's what electromagnetic radiation is. Electric fields that decay produce magnetic fields. Magnetic fields that decay produce electric fields. And you get an electromagnetic wave that propagates with the speed of light. Gravity has all of those features as well. In the case of electromagnetism, let us look at the electric field. The electric field can be decomposed, and again, we will do a similar decomposition for gravity in a moment. The electric field can be decomposed into what may be called a scalar part and what may be called a vectorial part. It's, of course, a vector field, the three-vector field. But it makes sense to decompose it in this way, and it's always possible, where the so-called scalar part is the gradient part of the electric field, and the remainder is the curl part of the electric field. Now, why is the gradient part called scalar part of the electric field? Well, the gradient part is the gradient of a scalar function. Every electric field, every three-vector field, in fact, can be decomposed on mathematical grounds alone, can be decomposed into the gradient of some scalar function plus a remainder, which is actually automatically the curl of some other vector field. So we can say that the scalar part is really only having as many degrees of freedom as a scalar function because it's just a gradient of a scalar function. You only need to specify scalar function to specify what the gradient part is. Whereas the vectorial part really is of truly vectorial character. The scalar part of the vector field is recognizable by the property that its curl is vanishing, and the vector part of the vector field is recognizable by the fact that its divergence is vanishing. I assume you've all seen things like that before in electromagnetism. Now, according to Maxwell equations, the scalar part, for example, of the electric field, has a divergence, which is the charge density. So the scalar part is sourced by the charges. It's where the charges sit. The vector part is charge independent. The vector part of the electric field is, by the Maxwell equations, minus dB by dt. It's given by the time derivative of the magnetic field. So we see here that the scalar part exists only where the charges are, right where the charges are. Wherever the charges are gone, this is not there. The curl part can exist even where there are no charges. So think of this solid that, you know, has electric fields inside and also electric and magnetic fields outside. And a similar argument can be given for the magnetic field. So all of this is standard electromagnetism. Now similarly, some curvature, some type of curvature, exists only right there where there is a source of it. Now, gravity is not sourced by charges and currents. Gravity is, that's curvature, is sourced by energy and momentum. So some curvature, some type of curvature, exists only right there where there is an energy density or a momentum density. And outside of a region where there is energy and momentum density, outside of that region, that type of curvature must be absent. But also, there is a type of curvature which is self-sustaining, which can exist even where there is no mass or energy. In the simplest case, consider the curvature in the vacuum of space a million miles away from the sun. Even if you're a million miles away from the sun, you still feel its attraction. That's because the sun causes curvature, and it causes curvature even a million miles away. That curvature is caused by the sun, but a million miles away from the sun, there is no matter of the sun. It's in vacuum. So that kind of curvature is supporting itself. It doesn't have to be only, it's not only where there is mass or there is energy and momentum. That's the simplest case, but there's also, and that case would be there also in Newtonian gravity. But in Einstein gravity, there are also, just like in electromagnetism, self-sustaining gravity waves. And in fact, they can also be decomposed in something that looks like an electric and something that looks like a magnetic part. So we should expect that the fluctuations of the metric tensor show all of this colorful behavior. All of this stuff should be able to go on in there. So some of the curvature is induced by inflaton inhomogeneities, which is, in the language that we just used, matter. Some of the fluctuations of the curvature will be because right there and then is a non-trivial energy momentum density. Wherever the inflaton field has a fluctuation that creates some bump in the energy momentum, well, that bump will show up as a curvature bump as well. And since this is what describes the fluctuations around FRW, homogeneity isotropy, it has to show up in here. But then there ought to be also some curvature inhomogeneities. There ought to be some part in this which can exist independently of the inflaton field. Curvature that exists even where there is nothing going on with energy and momentum. Gravitational waves. So those degrees of freedom of the metric have their own independent dynamics, and they need to be quantized on their own. But how then can we separate these different kinds of degrees of freedom that are in the metric? A very difficult task, because on one hand, we have to distinguish the behavior. Our task here is to analyze which parts of the metric tensor are sensitive to what's going on in energy momentum through the Einstein equation, and what part of the metric tensor doesn't care about energy momentum and has its own degrees of freedom. That in itself sounds difficult. But on top of that, there is the problem that the components of the metric tensor very much depend on the coordinate system. If you change coordinate system, you can, if you give yourself the freedom to choose another coordinate system, I mean, you have that freedom, then you could use that freedom, for example, to make sure that the top right component of the metric tensor gets the value 27. You can do that. There's always a coordinate system in which this happens, everywhere. This corner there has 27 in there. You can arrange for that. So the degrees of freedom are sitting in the metric tensor in a rather delocalized fashion. You can't just look at the individual components there and say, this one is means nothing, it's just coordinate artifact, and that component of the metric tensor means is a degree of freedom that's coupled to the inflaton field, and another one is another component of the metric tensor is simply a degree on its own, which is grabbed the gravitational wave. Not so easy. They are all mixed up because of the choice of, because of the arbitrariness of the coordinate system, and the components are whirled up together when you change coordinate system. So we'll have to somehow disentangle those things. And we'll do it by distinguishing three parts of the metric tensor, similarly to how a few slides further up, we distinguished two parts in the electric field. There is the part of the electric field that is scalar in nature, that is the gradient of some function, and there's the part that is the curl of some other vector field. And we notice that according to the Maxwell equations, the scalar part of the electric field is sourced by charges, whereas the curl part of the electric field can stand on its own. It can exist even where there are no charges. Now, we want to make a similar distinction here in the case of gravity. We want to find out which degrees of the metric, which degrees of freedom of the metric are sourced by the inflaton fields in homogeneities, and which degrees of freedom of the metric are not, and are their own degrees of freedom. So we do a similar decomposition now into scalar, into like a gradient and a curl, except this is not a vector field. This is a two-tensor. So the decomposition will have to go one step higher because this thing has two indices rather than one. What we do, therefore, is we decompose the metric perturbation into a part that can be derived from just scalar functions, and it's plural, several scalar functions. Things are more complicated when you're dealing with a tensor rather than a vector. And we decompose gamma into a second part, which can be derived from vector functions, vector fields, and a third part, a remnant part, which cannot be described in terms from a scalar, from scalar functions or vector functions, a part which is truly tensor, just like the curl part of the electric field is really vectorial. So this is the analog of decomposing into a gradient and a curl. We now have decomposition into a scalar, a vector, and a truly tensor part. So at every point in time, we want to make a decomposition of the spatial curvature of the metric in this way. let us write the metric in terms of the line element. So the metric in general is written as g mu nu, x and eta, and then dx mu, dx nu are the conformal time and the co-moving distances. Conformal time, co-moving distances. Then we can write the metric in the following way. So the invariant distance squared given by the metric is given by the usual FRW metric. Remember, this is the expression for Minkowski space multiplied with the scale factor. This is as simple as the line element or the metric looks like when we have FRW space-time in conformal time and co-moving space coordinates. This is the unperturbed part. And we write that the metric is the unperturbed part plus three perturbations of the metric. There's the scalar perturbations of the metric, the vector perturbations of the metric, and the tensor perturbations of the metric. Easy to write down like this, but we have to write down explicitly what they are. The scalar, what are the changes in the metric that are of scalar function origin? What are the changes in the metric that can be written as originating in a vector perturbation? And what are the truly tensorial perturbations? Well, let us look at the scalar perturbations first. Here the question is, how can we perturb the metric tensor? The metric tensor's spatial structure, how can we give it spatial curvature when we are allowed to use only scalar functions to achieve that, to write down that perturbation? Here are all possible ways it can be done. So here's the line element, the metric, scale factor, and then that's convenience. We could define the scale factor also inside here. We just put it out in front for convenience. So we have a scalar function, capital phi, multiplying the time element squared. We have a scalar function that we spatially differentiate. So we get one spatial index, and then we get another spatial index from dxi, d eta. This is the perturbation of the zero I components of the metric tensor. It's the derivative of a scalar function that has the right tensorial structure, right? And if you want to perturb the zero I components of the metric, then you need something with that structure, and that's how you can do it with a scalar function. You take a scalar function, differentiate it spatially, that gives you the I index, and then you have the zero index just on its own. You can also get the right structure by taking a scalar function and then contracting with the Kronecker delta ij. You can also get the right structure. You know, what is the right structure? We need the perturbation of the spatial metric, which is symmetric in the indices I and j. And if we just take the Kronecker delta, well, that's symmetric in ij multiplied with a scalar function. That's a valid perturbation of the metric. But we could also take a scalar function and take its spatial derivatives in the I and the j direction. And that, too, gives us a two-component symmetric tensor. That, too, is a kind of perturbation that the metric can experience that is generated by a scalar function. So what we see here is that, unlike in the case of the electric field, which has just one scalar potential, the metric has plenty, four of them. So if these are arbitrary scalar functions, we get perturbations to the metric, to the spatial curvature of the metric, that are of scalar origin. What about the vectorial perturbations of the metric? Perturbations of the metric that can be generated using vector functions. Well, we can take a vector function and use it to give us the zero I components of the perturbations of the metric. We can take a vector function and differentiate it with respect to the other index, symmetrize, and then again we get some a two component. Sorry, we get a two tensors that is symmetric in I and J simply because we symmetrized it. Okay, so Wi differentiated with respect to Xj may not be symmetric under the exchange of I and J, but if you add the symmetrically exchanged term, you get a valid contribution. So the metric can also be perturbed using vector valued functions in this way. So V and W are two three vector fields. And finally, there is a part of the metric, a part of the metric perturbation that cannot be expressed as the derivative of, as being derived from scalar functions or vectorial functions. It's the true tensorial part. It's a purely tensorial part hidden in the metric. Remember that the various parts can be recognized by characteristic properties that they have. For example, as we discussed in the case of electromagnetism, when you take the electric field and consider its scalar origin part, the gradient part, well, the gradient part doesn't have a curl. You can recognize the gradient part by its property of not having a curl. Whereas the curl part, the vectorial part, doesn't have a divergence. And here, it's quite similar. We can recognize the vectorial part by the fact that the two vector fields there will not have a divergence. And we find that the truly tensorial part has this property. Well, this set of properties. Of course, it has to be symmetric. The perturbations of the metric have to be symmetric because the metric is always symmetric. But it also is trace-free. And it also obeys this condition and looks like divergence-freeness. The trace-freeness, the fact that the perturbations of the metric are trace-free will tell some of you who have studied general relativity more deeply something. It indicates conformal invariance, and it indicates that we're dealing with gravitational waves. It's wild curvature. So we have now pretty complicated expressions for the perturbations of the inflaton field and the metric. Well, for the inflaton field, it's not too bad. It's just this the bulk inflaton field that does not depend on space at all, plus the inflaton fluctuations. But then the metric is written as the FRW metric plus the gamma mu nu, which, if we wanted to spell it out, would take about four lines of details with all the scalar, vector, and tensor perturbations. So I spare you all those details. You can imagine what happens if you put that expansion here of the metric in terms of scalar, vector, and tensor perturbations and the expansion of the inflaton field and plug it into the action. The action being the Einstein action plus the Klein-Gordon action. Plug those expansions in there and keep just the quadratic term. You have to go as far as quadratic in order to get equations of motion that are linear. Okay, so we put all that in there, and we get plenty of terms that contain all of those perturbations, in particular, of the metric. These are the four scalar degrees of freedom, and then there are two vectorial ones, and then there is the truly tensorial part. So it would seem that it's pretty horrible. We have plenty of degrees of freedom in this. And the metric seems to be very, very rich, has so many ways to fluctuate and dynamically evolve as far as its scalar degrees of freedom are concerned. The vectorial ones do what they want, and the tensorial degrees of freedom probably also have a party. So how can we handle all this complexity? It turns out that it's not that complex after all. Remember, we have made a decomposition of the metric tensor into scalar vector and tensorial origin parts. But there's one very crucial thing that we haven't made use of yet, and that is choice of coordinate system. Remember, you can choose your coordinate system such that a particular matrix element of the metric takes whatever value you want. That's not all you can do. Quite a bit. You have four free functions to choose when you choose a new coordinate system. The new x0 coordinate, this new x1, new x2, new x3 coordinate. Four completely free functions you get to choose, and that allows you to mess with the shape that the metric tensor takes. In particular, you get to choose what is equal time. The universe is a space-time continuum, and you get to choose how to foliate space-time into three-dimensional hypersurfaces. And we are decomposing here the metric spatially at each point in time. As you change your foliation, you're changing that decomposition. For example, there might be some part of space-time that's bulging out a little bit because of a fluctuation. Well, what if you just change your coordinate system? What if you just change your foliation of space-time such that what is equal time is now following that bulge? In that case, on your equal time surface, you don't see that bulge at all. Or maybe there is no bulge, but you choose a bulge in your coordinate system. And then you see one where there wasn't. Obviously, you can't have complete freedom in this. There's really something going on. It's not just a matter of perspective and a matter of choosing coordinates. But you see how intricate this business is. It turns out that there is an enormous power in choosing the foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces and choosing the coordinate systems around that. It turns out that we can choose our space-like hypersurfaces such that these functions, the four scalar functions, the two vectorial functions, and the one tensorial function that generate the fluctuations or that describe the fluctuations in the metric, the perturbations of the metric, we can choose the space-like hypersurface and the coordinates around them such that all of them vanish or at least dramatically simplify. It took a lot of wrong papers, a lot of discussion to figure this out, more than 10 years. So in other words, it takes more than a few slides to actually go through this, and it's pretty painful calculations. But if you are keen on those painful calculations, here they are. It's a paper by Brandenberger and others, pretty detailed, of 1992. The upshot of all of this is explained in this paper in a much more compact and more readable form. So the result of all this analysis is that as long as the inhomogeneities are small, as long as we are staying within first-order perturbation theory, nearly all of the inhomogeneities can be eliminated by a suitable choice of foliation and coordinate system. Except there are two fields, two degrees of freedom, which are independent of any choice of changing the slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, which are just there. They describe the actual physics of what's going on in a coordinate system independent way, or in the jargon of the field, in a gauge independent way, because often one speaks of choosing the space-like hypersurface as choosing a gauge, because it's just a similar procedure to what happens in gauge theory in particle physics. So what are these two fields? What are these two degrees of freedom that are really physical and independent of any choice of coordinates? Well, one degree of freedom, one out of the two, is given by this expression here. It's the so-called Mukhanov variable. And it describes a real perturbation of what's going on. It is given as a linear combination of the inflaton field phi and one of the four scalar fields that perturbed the metric. Remember, the metric was perturbed in various ways. Where is it? There it is. Here are all the scalar perturbations of the metric, and it's this one that survives. And what does it do? Well, nothing fancy, no derivatives involved. It simply multiplies the spatial metric with a factor, with a conformal factor. This degree of freedom psi simply describes a sort of local bloating or shrinkage of space. Remember, it is space as well as time dependent. So locally, this is describing a change to the metric which makes things closer together or further apart locally in an isotropic way, because it doesn't distinguish directions. It's just local, but doesn't distinguish directions. Okay, so this thing goes into the Mukhanov variable. Okay, so the Mukhanov variable is in part just that, up to a minus sign, but also it is proportional to the inflaton field. This is the mathematically exact way of saying that you can't distinguish fluctuations of the scalar part of the metric from fluctuations of the inflaton field. Remember, as we discussed earlier, the inflaton field fluctuates. That's why the Einstein equation will make the scalar part of the metric fluctuate. But you could also argue that fluctuations in the scalar part of the metric through the Einstein equation cause fluctuations in the inflaton field. In fact, the two are indistinguishable. They're just really one degree of freedom. And that is the degree of freedom that they are. So here's the inflaton field with some prefactor, and we will discuss later on why that's the right prefactor. And here is the scalar perturbation of the metric. So the statement is that the Mukhanov variable is real physics, independent of how you choose your slicing of space-time. The Klein-Gordon field is not. Neither is the scalar part of the metric. You can choose to change the slicing of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that this term is absent, and only that one is there. Or vice versa. You can choose a different slicing of your space-time into space-like hypersurfaces such that that term is absent and this one is there. Either way, whatever slicing you choose, how many percent of the Mukhanov variable is this, how many percent of it is that, but this value stays the same though. So let's say you have a fluctuation in the curvature. As we said earlier, you can always choose a space-like a foliation of space-time in a space-like hypersurface which follows the curvature, so that the scalar curvature is the same on your equal time surface. So you're making that thing vanish. But then you have no control over what the value of phi might be. And it turns out that then this picks up all of the value of the Mukhanov variable. Vice versa, you can choose your space-like hypersurface in such a way, the equal time surface in such a way that at equal time the value of the inflaton field is everywhere the same. Okay? But if you define your time variable in this way, well then the curvature may not be the same everywhere. And so this thing is then non-zero and the Mukhanov variable is made out of this. We will later discuss that decomposition of the Mukhanov variable into an inflaton part and into a scalar curvature part again when we discuss the case of De Sitter inflation. Because in the case of De Sitter inflation, this thing blows up and becomes ill-defined. Why is that? Well, let's look at it. The term a naught prime over a naught is harmless because the scale factor in the case of De Sitter is exponential. It's just a constant. It's fine, Hubble constant. But what about this thing here? This is phi naught. This is the bulk inflaton, the part that is not space dependent, right? So this is the large amplitude part of the classical part of the inflaton field. And the prime indicates the time derivative of it. And we have to the power of minus 1. So if the inflaton field were not to roll down a potential hill, if it were to just stay at the same value all the time, then phi prime would be 0. 1 over phi prime would be infinite. And this thing blows up and the Mukhanov variable becomes ill-defined. Therefore, it's a good thing that the standard model of cosmology doesn't rely on De Sitter inflation. In fact, it's much more realistic to assume, as we discussed, that the potential has a bit of a slope. And the inflaton field is slowly changing its value so that its potential slowly goes down. So phi naught prime is a finite value, and therefore this whole thing becomes stays finite. So we will come back to that in the case of the De Sitter inflation a little later on. Okay, so we have already predicted earlier on that the inflaton's inhomogeneities will combine with the curvature inhomogeneities to form one unified dynamical quantity, and that's the Mukhanov variable. And Mukhanov, by the way, is the same as the author, just the same Mukhanov as the author of that textbook that we are loosely following. One can show that the Mukhanov variable can be viewed as the intrinsic curvature, which roughly speaking measures how space is bloated. That is, if you choose your space-like hypersurface in such a way that it's the curvature that contributes to the Mukhanov variable. Remember, we did part one of two things. We said that you can, that in principle, the metric has a lot of degrees of freedom in it, but we can use our freedom to choose space-like hypersurfaces and the coordinate system, the coordinate systems that go along with that, in such a way to make many of those parameters that parameterize the metric perturbations go to zero, or at least simplify them a lot. And it turns out that the only survivors after choosing the slicing of spacetime into hypersurfaces and choosing the coordinate systems cleverly, the only surviving degrees of freedom are the Mukhanov variable and one other thing, not the vectors, the vectors go away, a spatial tensor field. What is also remaining after fixing the gauge, so to speak, is the tensorial, the truly tensorial part of the metric. There was only one truly tensorial part, and that thing is a survivor as well. It represents curvature that is independent of the energy momentum, just like electromagnetic fields that are independent of charges and currents that exist where even where there are not charges and currents. Something like traveling electromagnetic fields. This would be traveling gravitational fields, so-called wild curvature. Wild curvature is intuitively speaking, it's measuring not how much space is bloated, but how much space is distorted against itself. You could think of something like a rubber membrane, like a trampoline or something, you could bulge it out a little bit. That would correspond to scalar curvature. But you can also grab hold of it with your fingers and rotate it so that it doesn't actually change its shape, but it's sort of distorted against itself. It's just giving you some intuition, but it's not the actual thing that's happening. Two-dimensional curvature of a membrane doesn't have tensorial degrees of freedom, right? It only comes up in higher dimensions. Okay, but roughly speaking, just keep in mind that the Hij is a kind of curvature that doesn't shrink or blow up distances. It distorts space-time against itself. So then when we expand the Klein-Gordon action together with the Einstein action, then we no longer get this huge number of terms if we choose our slicing of space-time into time-like hypersurfaces cleverly and choose our coordinate systems cleverly. Then the action, here the Einstein action, there the Klein-Gordon action, and all the other matter terms are neglected here, then they reduce when then spelled out, they become much simpler terms. There are, of course, the terms that describe just the FRW dynamics with the bulk dynamics of the Klein-Gordon field, and then there's the action of the scalar and the tensorial degrees of freedom that we just discussed, the two surviving degrees of freedom after choosing after making use of the gauge freedom. Namely, the scalar action, the action that describes the dynamics of the Mukhanov variable, is this one. So the Mukhanov variable, remember, is a scalar field, a linear combination of the scalar curvature in the metric and the inflaton field. And the dynamics of the Mukhanov variable is given by this action, which fortunately looks like it's just of the same form as the action that we studied for the Klein-Gordon field. The Klein-Gordon action was just the same thing, only, you know, what we studied throughout the course, only we had the Klein-Gordon field over here, and we had the scale factor over there. Scale factor squared times derivative of the Klein-Gordon field, derivative of the Klein-Gordon field. That's what we studied throughout this course. Now we know better. We know that that's not really the Klein-Gordon field is not a physical degree of freedom. The perturbations of the Klein-Gordon field are not the physical degrees of freedom. They are intertwined with the scalar degrees of freedom, or with the scalar degree of freedom of curvature. And together, they form one physical degree of freedom, which is the Mukhanov variable. And so the Klein-Gordon field is buried in there, together with the scalar part of the metric. And the true dynamics of that physical degree of freedom, of that observable coordinate system independent degree of freedom, the true dynamics is described by this action here, where the scale factor is replaced by this. Now, you might ask, well, what about that? Isn't that weird? That ought to be the scale factor. Because if it's not, horizon crossing won't happen at the right time. And in any case, what is this Z? Why would it not be the scale factor? Okay, so we will discuss why it's not the scale factor exactly a little later when we are more prepared to discuss why that term has to take exactly that form. But for now, let us just compare it with the scale factor. This Z, here's the box for it, is a function like the scale factor. It's just a function of conformal time. And in fact, it's pretty close to being the scale factor. It's just a small perturbation around it. It's just not in the sense of spatial perturbation. It's just a little correction to the scale factor. And how do we see that? Well, the Z function, according to which the Mukhanov variable is evolving, is given by the scale factor squared over the derivative of the scale factor times the derivative of the Klein-Gordon field, where this is the bulk Klein-Gordon field. I've put indices 0 in here. Remember, this stuff is not quantized. This is just the bulk classical scale factor according to FRW and the bulk inflaton field that is spatially isotropic and homogeneous. This is basically the scale factor for the following reason. We have that A naught over A prime is just given by the Hubble parameter, which is a constant. Right? So when the universe is expanding almost exponentially fast, then A over A prime is a constant. And so it's basically behaving like A, and that would be almost a constant as well when we have when we are in this slow roll period. Again, we will discuss that more a little later. So just to compare, this was the action of the Klein-Gordon field that we studied all along. Now, we want to study the action of the Mukhanov variable, and we see that we can use all the math and the physics that we developed earlier. We just have to reinterpret things a little bit. Everything we said about the inflaton field, we really should have said about the Mukhanov variable. And when we were talking about the scale factor, we should have talked about this Z factor there. Well, and then there was the second degree of freedom. Apart from the Mukhanov variable, the other survivor after choice of coordinates and getting rid of extra variables, the other survivor was the tensorial degrees of freedom, Hij. And it turns out that the action for the tensorial degrees of freedom comes out like this. That's the action of the tensor field. Compare that with the Klein-Gordon action and be pleasantly surprised, because it's the same thing again. This is basically the same equation as the Klein-Gordon equation, except that we have a whole matrix of entries here, the perturbations of the metric, whereas the Klein-Gordon field is just a scalar. But other than that, and apart from a prefactor of 1 over 64 pi g, this is really the action of a Klein-Gordon field, except it's now metric perturbations. So what we see is that the truly tensorial perturbations of the metric obey the Klein-Gordon equation. Really, they obey, of course, the Einstein equation. But in that approximation, it reduces to this, just the Klein-Gordon equation. So that's great, because it means we can recycle what we did in this course yet again. This time, instead of working with the inflaton field, we work with the metric perturbations. And we don't even have to change the scale factor. The scale factor arises just as it ought to arise. And we just have to make sure that we keep that constant in the game. So our task then is to quantize the Mukhanov variable and the tensor fluctuations of the metric. What are the equations of motion? We can read them off right away from the action. I leave it to you as an exercise to derive them. The equation of motion for the Mukhanov variable is this one. Recognize the friction term. The equation of motion for the tensor degrees of freedom is this one. Both are, of course, just the Klein-Gordon equation. This one with the proper scale factor, this one with this Z factor. So what should be our strategy for quantizing this? Well, we simply use all the tools that we developed throughout the course. The one first trick that we employ is to use auxiliary fields, to define auxiliary fields to get rid of that friction term here, so that we then simply obtain a harmonic oscillator equation with a time-varying frequency. Previously in this course, we took the Klein-Gordon field, which obeyed the same Klein-Gordon equation as above with the friction term, and we multiplied it with the scale factor to obtain an auxiliary field chi, which then obeyed this Klein-Gordon equation, which no longer had a friction term, which no longer had a term that was proportional to the first derivative of chi, but instead had a time dependence in there. We can do the same thing here. For the Mukhanov variable, we multiply the Mukhanov variable with what would be the scale factor for it, z. This minus has historical reasons. It doesn't really change anything. And so we obtain a new auxiliary field u, and its equation of motion is the Klein-Gordon equation here. You see that the minus sign drops out of this equation. So again, the auxiliary field that comes for that goes along with the Mukhanov variable obeys the Klein-Gordon equation without friction term. And the same thing we do for the tensorial components. Here we have the tensorial, the truly tensorial components of the metric perturbations. Remember, they are recognized by being trace-free. This matrix has to be trace-free. It has to be divergence-free with respect to the i's and with respect to the j's. And it has to be symmetric. So for each one of those degrees of freedom, we define, again, a degree of freedom, an auxiliary degree of freedom that differs from it by the scale factor, and again, historically motivated this prefactor. Then the Klein-Gordon equation obeyed by that auxiliary field is again this one, just the same as for the Klein-Gordon field, just the same as for the auxiliary field that comes along with the Mukhanov variable. So really, we've already done all of the work. We just have to reinterpret a little bit what we did in terms of the new variables there. So then the goal is to go through the quantum theory of these auxiliary fields, the U field and the P field, the U for the Mukhanov variable, the P for the tensorial degrees of freedom, and then calculate the quantum fluctuations in this way of the Mukhanov variable and the tensorial fluctuations. We have to calculate how large these fluctuations are when the field's modes, when the mode k crosses the horizon, the Hubble horizon during inflation. We could also calculate what the fluctuation size is after they cross the Hubble horizon, but it's going to be the same number. Because remember that once a mode has crossed the horizon, the amplitude of its fluctuations stay the same. So we might as well calculate it at one particular time, which is the crossing of the horizon, and then it stays the same there. So that is going to be our job then for the next lecture. Let me just quickly mention what the observational implications are. Fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable give us local space-time expansion, and therefore something like cooling fluctuations in the hot gas of the primordial universe. And eventually, that showed up as temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. There's another way of looking at this, which is that it's really a Doppler shift. Not a Doppler shift. It's when you have fluctuations of the curvature, then even if the gas is at exactly the same temperature everywhere, the photons still have to sometimes climb out of a potential well, gravitational well, or they come down from a potential hill, and so they either get red or blue shifted, which to a faraway observer looks like the temperature was different. Whereas the fluctuations of the tensorial part of the metric give us the quantum fluctuations of the tensorial part of the metric are quantum fluctuations of gravitational waves. And the prediction has been that this should leave an imprint in the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. So if you plot the polarization as a vector field in the sky, where the polarization vectors are not really vectors because they're missing heads, they're just giving you a direction without distinguishing this way or the opposite. But if you take that vector field, then its curl is given by the gravitational waves. That's been predicted, and the big deal last Monday was that the BICEP2 experiment found those fluctuations in the CMB. And therefore, evidence for quantum fluctuations of the metric itself. Quantum fluctuations that were frozen in, you know, 10 to the minus 32 seconds after whatever caused our universe to come into existence. Okay, so we go through the quantization then on Thursday.